everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, April 2nd, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. And before we dive into this week's episode, I want to thank Waterline, who sponsored the show. You've heard me talk about them before. I'm going to continue on this quest because I want you guys to listen to the new Waterline podcast. Go to the website right now, or go to iTunes, go to Stitcher, but also you can go to their website. Just Google Waterline Israeli New Tech. And there's a bunch of episodes that are just super compelling. Today, I want to talk to you about the episode entitled Low Tech to High Tech Entrepreneurship, which really does focus on some of the newest, most high tech ways that we are approaching the water industry, which was historically a really low tech industry. It really talks about how innovation, hard work, and luck play a role in any venture, especially the world of water. So guys, search Waterline Podcast on iTunes or in your Android podcast app and give it a listen. I know you won't be disappointed. I also want to thank those of you who promoted the show this week and every week by going to my website, www.carasantamaria.com, and clicking through the links there, or by visiting patreon.com/talknerdy. It's because of you, the supporters of the show, that we can keep this going week after week. I actually just got back from the Amazon rainforest, but I'm recording this before I left, so I don't have anything to report quite yet. But once I get back in a week, which will actually be now, oh my gosh, it's so confusing when you pre-record intros, then I'll be able to update you guys on what's going on. But I'd rather just dive right into the show this week because it's a really, really fun one. I have an author on. She's also actually the editor of New York Magazine's Science of Us website. Her name is Melissa Dahl, and she's just written a new book called Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. So we're going to be diving into the psychology of awkwardness, why we feel so ugh when certain things happen, and really what it has to do with it's happening in our own minds. Just the best. Super funny, super interesting. So without any further ado, guys, here she is, Melissa Dahl. Well, Melissa, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. Yeah, this is going to be fun.
All right. I am really excited to chat with you about your new book, Cringeworthy, which, by the way, has the funniest book jacket I've ever seen. This little kid.
I know. It's so cute. He's like, I don't know if it's he or she, but the baby.
I can't
baby.
Tell either.
Yeah, but the baby's making this kind of just like, oh boy, kind of face.
What did you do? So Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. And of course, before we dive into the book, I want to talk a little bit about you and what you do and kind of, you know, some background, because I think it helps understand why this book is so exciting. So you are the founding editor of New York Mag's Science of Us.
Yes. I mean, I should say there were two of us, co-founder. But yeah,
co-founder.
I came on to New York Mag in 2014 and launched the site, and then kind of took over as main editor just a little bit after that. And yeah, the Science of Us now is part of The Cut, which is a New York Mag site that kind of focuses on women's issues and stuff. But we still... Mm-hmm. do our thing. We just are located on The Cut now.
And so what made you first want to push kind of for that science niche? Or do you have a strong background in science? Is that where you started?
Yeah. So it's kind of funny the way I came about it. I started in newspapers. I was a features reporter, and I was just always interested in, you know, why people do the things that they do, you know? So I was always like calling up psychologists and that sort of thing to kind of explain human behavior, behavioral science. And then I mean, this was like long ago in my career. I got a job in my first internship was in the health section at MSNBC.com. And I, you know, was like way out of my depth. I'd studied journalism, but I hadn't studied science, but just kind of one of my good friends at work, she just kind of like took me under her wing right from the beginning. And she would walk by my desk and she would just say like, you're going to have to Elle Woods this, which by what she meant was like, go the route of like Legally Blonde. And
that's
just
so
like,
cute.
It was very cute. Yeah. Just like study the hell out of it. And so I did. And I just, you know, I just subscribed to like abstracts from just every journal I could think of and started kind of you know, reading these academic E's and calling the magic of being a journalist is you can read the paper and then call up the academic who wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so I just kind of really, it's all from a place of genuine curiosity about why we do the things we do, why the human mind and brain and body work the way they do. And if that means I'm going to have to suffer through this jargony 10-page paper, okay.
I love that. And I love hearing about the way that different science journalists kind of come up, because I hear all the time from young people who are interested in doing science communication or science journalism, like, what path should I take?
Yeah.
And it's like, there is no true path. Like, you can go to J school, you can go, you know, you can study science and you can learn the other skills on the job. Some people have some sort of like hybrid education, which is awesome. I didn't know that that existed, you know, when I was first coming up.
I wish if I could go back in time, I would have done that, but I just didn't, you know, my highest ambition, I wanted to be a newspaper reporter, just like a general assignment newspaper reporter. But then I just fell in love with this stuff. And it was the other kind of learning on the job. But I've been doing it now for about 11 years. So now I do have the experience, but it's so much fun.
And in a way, I think it's really cool because you get to see, I think, what a lot of multidisciplinary work really, like, why it's necessary and what it really is. Because sometimes actually in the sciences, like the people who are in the labs doing this work, never talk to other researchers who are in an allied field because it may be in a different department.
Absolutely. I went to this really cool interdisciplinary conference last year. It was the greatest name. It was called A Symposium of Neglected Emotions.
And oh, no, that's hilarious.
It was amazing. It was so great. I think it was just a one-time thing. I would go every year. But that was the point of it. You know, it was like neuroscientists and philosophers and psychologists. And then me, I showed up to talk about awkwardness. And just learning from each other and different ways of looking at kind of the same questions was extremely cool. But yeah, it is something that I think a lot of us don't do enough of, no matter what field we're in, but yeah, particularly the sciences.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Like you, of course, to write this book, which we'll dive into in just a second, you, of course, probably had to talk to all sorts of experts from, like you said, health-related fields, psychology, neuroscience, like all these different fields where oftentimes I think we don't ever talk to each other. And then what ends up happening, sadly, is that people like reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, right, right. I mean, that actually kind of turned out to be the magic of writing this book. I mean, like I kind of was talking about how really my main motivator in my job and my main motivator, maybe, I don't know, throughout life has just been curiosity. I just want to know stuff. Mm-hmm. I have questions and I want to get them answered. And that's what I've always loved about this job. But I realized this very weird questions I had about, you know, what makes us cringe, what makes awkward situations feel so uncomfortable. I couldn't find, there wasn't like a department of awkwardness studies. and so when I was first working on the book, a part of me was like, oh no, maybe there's nothing here, you know, because if you're working on, I don't know, I read a great kind of popular press book about uncertainty, this book called Nonsense. And there's a ton of psychology research on uncertainty. And so kind of talking about like the idea of interdisciplinary, the importance of that, I kind of was forced to look further afield than just this theory in psychology, because there wasn't one about what makes us cringe. So that turned out to be super, super fun. So I would highly recommend it to anybody.
Yeah, and that's why you got to literally call your book Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness, because you really set out to kind of develop this hypothesis, this theory, because there kind of wasn't one.
There wasn't one. And I mean, like I said, it just, the whole book was out of curiosity and almost maybe a little annoyance that this didn't exist, you know, like this is a, this is like a feeling that happens to all of us. And I just couldn't find answers that, you know, I couldn't find one overarching theory or like a couple overarching theories or something. So yeah, I just made my own.
So I have to ask, because I want to dig a little deeper. Obviously, a lot of the work that you've done through the years, and including this book, which is your first book, right?
It is, yeah.
Oh, how exciting.
Yeah.
including this book was really sort of motivated by just pure unbridled curiosity. But what is it that made you, I mean, obviously when you first started to dig and you realized there's just not that much out there and you wanted to learn more, but what made you first be like, oh yeah, this is totally interesting to me? Do you cringe a lot? Do you have like, do you have a problem with this, or do you cringe differently than some of your friends? Like, why is it that you were like, oh my gosh, I have to understand this?
My theory about myself is, I kind of read about this in the introduction. As a kid, we moved around a lot. And, you know, every kid, and especially every teenager, is paying super close attention to social norms and kind of what makes something cool and what makes something not cool and what would make you stand out in a bad way and what would make you stand out in a good way. And so that's not unusual. But I think because we were moving every year and a half to 2 years, I learned those social norms over and over and over again, like a new set and then another new set and another new set. And so I think I just became sort of really highly attuned to the moments that just make you stand out in a bad way. These moments that kind of when you say something and it was the wrong joke to make and you didn't know why, or when you something was cool at your old school and then here it's kind of embarrassing at your new school. So that's my kind of like armchair psychology, you know, version of why I was so interested in this. But I have to say the thing that really made me excited about writing the book was the subject just made me laugh. The more I looked into it. I mean, writing sucks, but when I got to sit down and kind of just think about like, okay, what am I writing about today? Oh, like why we cringe at the sound of our own voices. Like, cool. That's awesome. I'm going to write about that. So
can I just say, okay, you're a professional writer. And the fact that you just said that makes me feel so much better about every life decision I've ever made. I'm back in school right now. My listeners know this. I'm working on my PhD. Finally, I'm finishing it or starting to finish it. And I have to write so much and I hate writing.
It's worse.
I love that you're, because I have talked to some writers who are like, oh yeah, I just love it. And I'm like, shut up. Is that true?
I have to like trick myself into loving it. Like I don't know. It would be nice if like every time I sat down, it was like, oh, I just feel so inspired and this is so wonderful. But I didn't have the luxury of that because I kept my full-time job while writing too. So I was just like, you know what? You were writing from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. tonight, and that's when you have to write and go. That's all that's all the time you got. So do it.
Oh, wow.
But I do think like when I would get into it, I mean, there's a reason I'm a writer professionally. I do love it, but it also sucks.
Oh, I love it. All right. So let's talk about some of the things that you had. I don't know. You had even just mentioned, like, I would love to know when you were a kid, you're going from school to school. You're having to kind of start over. You were mentioning how there were like different sort of social mores.
Yeah.
I've always been really fascinated by this too. Like, why are those kids the popular kids?
Yeah.
Why do those kids have a hard time finding friends? Why is it that like at one school, it's super cool to be in band, and at another school, like the band kids are the nerds?
Yeah. It's very confusing when that's your life. I mean, and just things like fashion trends, you know, when I was a freshman, it was like the late 90s and we lived in Southern Louisiana for a really brief period. And I don't know, maybe fashion trends take longer to get there or something, but those like Clueless style kind of knee socks were still very cool.
Oh.
And yeah, in like in the late 90s, which I don't think was true elsewhere, but so I was like, okay, noted, you know, and that's like what everybody wore with their gym clothes. And so I did that. And then I showed up to my new school when we moved to California and I wore those knee socks. And everyone looked at me like, what is she wearing? Because it was like the, you know, the no-show socks were cool there. So just little things like that. It is so strange. Or like, yeah, at that school, like the soccer team was kind of like the football team. Like they were like the cool guys. It is very weird.
That is weird, especially in the U.S. Like most kids play soccer growing up, but soccer is definitely not like prioritized. Football is usually it. Well, I grew up in Texas, so that's super different too. Like I was definitely at a Friday Night Lights school. So of course football was it.
Yeah. Or like, you know, I would move somewhere and like pick up the slang or something. Like in Northern California, I still miss this word. I picked up the word hella.
yep.
Which is a hella great word, I have to say. And then I moved away from California, and everyone just made so much fun of me. One of my friends at work started calling me hella because I said it so much. But yeah, it kind of is. I know we all know this, but it's a nice reminder that there is no such thing as like a universal like thing that is cool. It's so dependent on context. So
absolutely. I mean, there really is that like important sociological component to it, right? That kind of where you are, what your family's like,
yeah,
what the customs are, all of that plays into it. But there are some things, or are there, that are just universally cringeworthy, right?
Yes, I think that is true. I mean, you know, for this book, I kind of spent a while just kind of tracking how we were using the word cringeworthy or awkward, which I think is mm-hmm. kind of, you know, a similar thing. And, you know, one of the things we say make us cringe is like hearing the sound of your own voice on a on a recording specifically.
Oh, that's why I pay somebody to edit my podcast.
Do you really?
Like, yes.
That's so interesting.
I can't.
Oh my God.
Used to, yeah. For like 150 episodes, I did it myself. But finally, when I was able to afford to, I was like, the greatest joy in my life will be to not have to listen to my own voice anymore.
You know, I've been doing a ton of like radio and podcast interviews, and a lot of people have said that. People who do mm-hmm. this like professionally, you know? It's so mm-hmm. interesting.
Yeah, and I do a lot of television too, and that's really bad if I'm happening, especially when I was working as a broadcast journalist, because I would be in the office and I would have to go into post and sit with the editor and do like scratch recordings. And I was like, I can't be in this room anymore. Yeah. I cannot listen to you replay me saying that one sentence 500 times in a row.
Oh, and I like looking at myself on camera, and like, oh no. Yeah. So, I mean, that kind of gets at the heart of what I consider my kind of cringe theory. Just super briefly, you might have read about this before because it's been written about, but I was doing a story a couple years ago for Science of Us about that question of why we cringe at the sound of our own voices. And this is like super simplified explanation of it. But basically, like, typically when I'm hearing myself talk, I hear it through the air, but I also hear it through the bones of my own skull. And I guess bone conduction transmits sound at a lower frequency. So that kind of helps explain, I don't know about you, but whenever I hear my own voice, I'm just like, oh my God, I sound like a teenager. You know, I sound like a chipmunk. So that's kind of helps explain why. And that story's kind of been done because it is such a cliche. So many of us say this, you know, we hate the sound of our own voices. But when I was writing that piece, I was like, okay, so that explains why it sounds different. But why does that make us cringe?
Yeah, why do we actually hate it?
Yeah. And we don't hate it because there's some research showing if you play people a whole bunch of different voices, like so many that their own voice kind of gets lost, they like their voices. Hmm. So it's not really even that we hate it. It's more that it just sounds different than it does in our own heads.
Hmm.
And so that kind of is what made me think that maybe the things that we say make us cringe is when the kind of version of you that you hold in your head clashes with the version of you other people are seeing. And kind of when those things don't measure up, and particularly when the you in your own head was kind of this idealized version, and then you see how other people see you and you're like, oh no. I don't even think it has to necessarily be that there's a kind of a drop between, oh, you thought you were so great, but you know, other people don't. It's just when there's that difference, when you realize that people aren't seeing you the way you think you're coming across, I think those are often the situations we say make us cringe.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that that's probably really, really common too.
Mm-hmm.
We live with ourselves every day, and we have built up this idea of like what it is we have to offer the world, what we're good at, what we're bad at, all those things. And I mean, I say this to my girlfriends all the time, like, lest we forget, when we look in the mirror, we see something very different than the rest of the world sees. And usually we actually see something that's like, you know, negatively valenced. Like, we actually notice things that other people don't notice, or quirky things that we hate other people find really endearing.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't think it's necessarily always that like you have this idealized version of you in your head, but it's just even the idea that other people see you in a way, other people see you differently than you see yourself is like a really strange kind of existential fear. It's very weird to think about that. And they're, you know, talk about looking at yourself in the mirror. There's been some research on that where they showed people little cutouts of like just their faces, and either the mirror version or the kind of non-mirror version. And
oh yeah, because it's flipped, right?
Yeah. So people tend to like their own mirror version better, but other people like the non-mirror version. So even that's kind of weird. Yeah. Or just another example. I say this in the book, but I used to blog a lot for my job, and I like to think of myself, I think I am pretty funny. And like, you know, I think I tend towards topics that are going to make people's day a little more interesting. But a friend of mine, I blogged something just really quickly about like some new research on loneliness. And a friend of mine on GChat sent me the link and was like, I knew this was you before I clicked. Your stories are always the saddest. I was like, what?
Oh my gosh.
I know. Like, what? I don't see myself that way. Like, so, yeah, it's, I think that's kind of the heart of what makes us cringe.
Oh, wow. That's so interesting. That's what did that like awaken something in you when she said that?
Well,
do you like think differently about how you pitch now, or do you still just kind of do what you've always done?
Well, it's like overall, you know, if these things that make us cringe are when we are hearing something from somebody else that like surprises us about ourselves and about the way they see us, like I try to think of it as it's interesting information to take in and like consider it, but it doesn't always mean they're right. I don't think she's right. But was also like, interesting. That is interesting information to take in. But it can be really valuable to see yourself through somebody else's eyes. Like you just can't see a totally accurate view of yourself. So
yeah, I mean, I think that for a lot of people, you know, I'm back in school studying clinical psychology, and I think for a lot of people, that's what therapy is.
Yeah.
It's having an ally for sure. Like your therapist is there for you and only for you and only has your best interests at heart. But they can sometimes offer a mirror that maybe is like less of a carnival funhouse mirror than the one that you hold in your own head.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it'd be insane to suggest that other people are always right about you. But I also think it's worth not just dismissing those observations, yeah. You know, which is kind of what I think our default is, you know, like, you know, situations like when you're like, oh, that's not what I meant. You know, you're taking that the wrong way. OK, well, that's how they took it, though. So that's actually valuable information that like you meant it this way, but that's not how they took it. So you should note that. And I think
that's a really important insight too, because I think we do that a lot. It's like, oh, well, you're misunderstanding me. It's like, well, then maybe I should be a little more clear.
Exactly. Yeah. How much does it matter what you meant if that's not how it was, you know?
That's true, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm interested then, you know, you talk a lot in the book about things that make us feel awkward or like things that make us cringe. It's funny because you use cringeworthy and awkwardness often throughout the book as synonyms. When I first think about the word awkwardness, I think about like, I am awkward. Mm-hmm. Like I am an awkward human being. And then when I think about cringeworthy, I think about things other people do.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah.
Did you make that kind of distinction at all?
I did in my head. I don't think I made it super clear in the book, but I think that we cringe over ourselves too. But the way I thought about it is like, you kind of cringe over your past self, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's almost like you're thinking of that other, as your past self, as another person, you know, like when a memory comes back to you about something embarrassing you did and you like, you like cringe over that.
Oh my gosh, that's so true.
Yeah.
I had an ex-boyfriend. He used to always say this phrase when he would talk about his past. He would always say, who was in my body?
Yeah, for sure. I mean,
like,
who was
that person?
I know. And there's some research showing that too, that we, particularly we think of our future selves. We tend to think of as separate people from our present selves, but we do that with our past selves too.
Hmm.
And so there's kind of, I mean, it makes sense. And there's kind of I think there's some benefit to maybe looking at your past self as if it's a separate person. It's not, you know, so also leaving some space in your head for like, okay, that also is totally still me.
Yeah.
But thinking of yourself as a separate person, you know, 16-year-old you it is you, but it also isn't you, you know? So keeping that separation in your head, I think, can be kind of valuable. It can kind of remind you that you have changed and you have grown, and it makes sense that you're cringing over past Melissa's behavior because she was a different person. So, yeah.
Absolutely. What about when, you know, we have nothing to do with the awkward situation? Or maybe I'm like catching myself as I'm saying this, because we always have something to do with it because we are the observer. Mm-hmm. But what if we are not an active participant? Like, we're literally watching a train wreck happen in front of us. And because there are just, it seems to be, people who consistently do and say super awkward things. Yeah. And some people actually lean into that. I find living in LA that some comedians and stuff learn that about themselves early and made that their thing. And it actually works for them. But then there's other people who seem to be blissfully unaware.
I know. For the book, I kind of made a distinction between awkwardness as kind of a personality trait and awkwardness as an emotion, because I don't know what to do with people who, you know, it's just part of their personality and who don't feel this way. You know, it would be nice on the one hand to be blissfully unaware, but I'm kind of glad that I'm not, because everyone else in the room is feeling it. And if I'm not feeling it too, there's no way I could ever make any kind of change, you know, because I think sometimes this feeling does alert you to something that maybe needs to change about you. Mm. So I'm glad for those folks who can just say super awkward things and just move on with their lives. But I'm glad I'm not one of them. So.
Yeah, I think that I'm kind of reminded of like Curb Your Enthusiasm or something like that. You know, it's sort of, that show is really based on just being awkward, but it's spun in such a way that I think the humor carries you through those like heart palpitation moments.
right. Or like Michael Scott is a good example too, from The Office. Yeah. Like he is, you know, quote unquote, like an awkward person, but I don't think he spends a lot of time like dwelling in, you know, self-consciousness. I don't think he has, you know, flashbacks from season one or whatever, that awkward thing I did. And so good for him walking through the world like that, but I would rather be a little more self-aware.
Oh, for sure. And it makes you wonder if Michael Scott and Larry David both have sort of like a narcissism to them that makes it okay for them to be that way, because they do sort of have some of those traits as well. You know, like they're awkward, but they're also amazing.
Yeah.
And they don't notice that they're awkward because they're so amazing.
Yeah. I think that's probably fair. Yeah. I think another type of person who doesn't feel awkward is just like the shameless kind of person, you know, because a lot of this has to do with, it's like a mild version of feeling shame. Shame can be a useful emotion when not, I mean, I don't want to, obviously not in, you know, when controlled or when, you know, in small doses or something, but it can alert you to maybe that's not something, maybe that wasn't a good joke to tell, you know. It's, you know, that the classic kind of like asking a woman when she's due and she's not pregnant. Okay, maybe don't comment on women's appearances. Maybe that's what you want there.
It's true. It seems like there's always a continuum with a lot of these, whether they be personality traits or just individual encounters like we're talking about. There is this sort of continuum that feeling remorseful or feeling shameful after saying or doing something that made people feel uncomfortable is important feedback to help us correct.
It is.
But then there are people who don't do it enough, and maybe that tends into sort of a narcissism side of the spectrum. But then there are people who unfortunately obsess over it all the time. Yeah. Like they have a high level of anxiety, and it actually, that social anxiety prevents them from being able to enjoy their lives because they're so worried.
Yeah.
It's almost like they're, you know, like high all the time. You know how when you're really, really high and you're just super paranoid that everything you say is stupid.
I've been right there. Yeah. I mean, I think that the other side of this, to not be driven crazy by it, you know, there, I was thinking about this the other day, actually. I think there are kind of like two types of people who aren't driven nuts by, you know, cringing over their past selves or their current self. And one is the shameless type of person, which I don't think you want to be. I hope you don't want to be that. I don't. But the other kind of person is a kind of a self-accepting person. And what I mean by that is someone who acknowledges their role in whatever embarrassing mishap occurred and doesn't minimize it, you know, doesn't say like, I don't know. I made a joke in a meeting the other day that totally didn't go over well. And I've been thinking about that. Like, so it's not like, it's not minimizing it. It's not like saying like, oh, that didn't happen or whatever. It's acknowledging like, yeah, it happened. Yeah. That probably was like, maybe not the right tone to strike, but also just zooming out and being like, that's also not the most embarrassing thing that even happened in New York today, you know, like,
yeah.
And just being a little easier on yourself, I think, is the other way to get through this.
So you live in New York?
Yes.
Okay. I lived there for 1 year and yeah. It was a very awkward year for me.
Oh yeah. How so?
I did not adjust well. I mean, for other reasons, dealing with depression, it being dark and cold and the buildings blocking the sun and it was snowing and it was a terrible winter. And you know, I'm from Texas and was like, what is this white stuff on the ground?
Oh yeah.
But even beyond that, coming from Texas straight to New York, I remember my mom's a New Yorker. She was, you know, born in Puerto Rico, then grew up in New York City in the mm-hmm. Bronx. And I remember telling her, like, people here are so mean. And she was like, why, what happened? And I was like, I asked this woman if I could sit next to her on the subway. And she looked at me like I was crazy. And she's like, that's because you don't ask that question. You just sit. I was like, ah, I don't know the rules.
I know.
And so, you know, you mentioned in your book a few experiences that are like very New York, like just talking to people on the subway, which are so awkward.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So the subway thing was a total, kind of was one of the things that helped spark the book idea. You know, people ask me what made you want to write about this, and there are a million different reasons, but this story I did for Science of Us was one of the reasons. There was some study that was done out of the University of Chicago a couple of years ago where they had some folks kind of just do their commute as normal. And then they had other people, they were like, okay, you're going to have to talk to whoever sits next to you on the train on your way in into the city. And they asked them, you know, how much do you think you'll enjoy your commute? And the people who were in the condition where they were going to have to chat with somebody on the train were just like, that sounds horrible. No, thank you. Uh-huh. In the end, they ended up really enjoying their commute. And everybody wrote about this just with a total straight face. And I remember reading those articles. This was like back in 2014 when I just started at Science of Us. And I was like, yeah, right. That sounds horrible. You know, that sounds like the worst thing ever. No, thank you. And so I like pitched to my editor at the time. I was like, why don't I try that? Like, I'll try that for a week. You know, I'll just like recreate the conditions of the experiment to see how it really goes. And he was like, sure, whatever. So I did it. And it was like this hugely popular story for us. And I have to admit, like, it actually was like the overall experience was kind of cool because, like, you know, people just don't do that, you know. And I had some situations where I just asked someone next to me the time and they kind of just like looked at me like, what are you doing, you know. But I had some really nice experiences too where there was I really did. There was a gal next to me who was reading a book that I had just read. And I just, you know, my rules were if I had to, whoever sat down next to me, I had to strike up a conversation with them. And so I mentioned something about the book and we talked for like, I don't know, 10 minutes or something. And then the conversation kind of died down. And then she got up off to, you know, it was her stop. And so then she turns around and says like, bye, have a good day. And it was just like the nicest little moment. And so that was kind of one of the things I thought about that made me really interested in this feeling of awkwardness. Like, maybe there's some good to be had in here. But generally, yes, talking to strangers on the subway is an extremely awkward thing to do.
Do you remember this study that came out in 2014? Like, as you were talking about this, I was inspired to talk about it. And I reference it a lot on the show, where they took a bunch of people and put them in a room. And first they asked them like how likely they were to like harm themselves with electricity. And most people were like, no, I pay money not to be harmed with electricity. And then they put them in a room all alone with just like a shock machine.
Yeah. I totally remember that. Yeah, that's so funny. I wonder what I would do.
Well, apparently only 25%. I just looked it up again because I'm like, most people shock themselves, which I've been overly stating that. 67% of men and 25% of women chose to inflict pain on themselves rather than to just sit there quietly with their thoughts.
Wow. What an interesting gender
divide.
So there
is a big gender difference.
Yeah.
There. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I don't think anybody really wrote about that. That's so interesting.
It's super weird, though, that there is something about just being alone with our own thoughts that's obviously so psychically like uncomfortable for us. I wonder if there's a big tie-in with this sort of awkwardness literature or the, you know, minimal awkwardness literature that's out there. It's just something very, I don't know, strange and uncomfortable about just thinking and being.
For me, I mean, my brain will just float back to all the embarrassing things I've ever said, you know, that day and the previous day. And I mean, every cab ride home from a party, I'm like, oh, why'd you say that? That was stupid. Why did you know? So that's where my brain would go.
Yeah, that might be a big part of it. I wouldn't be surprised if we do the same thing. Ugh. What about, okay, improv.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm like, what are the worst things that I've ever done in my life?
Oh my God.
Improv.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So that was part of this. I did a story for, a lot of this came out of pieces I did for Science of Us, but I did a story on this guy who is a clinical psychologist in Boston who works with people who have social anxiety, and he makes them go through, he kind of has like a type of exposure therapy for them where he kind of has them think about the worst social situation they can think of, the most embarrassing thing they can think of. And he's like, okay, now go do it. And he has them do really ridiculous things. Like they'll go into a bookstore and ask the clerk, like, excuse me, do you have any books about farting? Or they'll, you know, go to a drugstore and say to the cashier, like, do these condoms come in smaller sizes?
I'm such a child because I'm like, that's hilarious.
I know. I am too. I know. It's so funny. But for me, I was kind of thinking about my own version of this. Like, what is the worst thing I could think of doing? And the worst thing I could think of was like trying improv, honestly. And so I was like, all right, you got to go try it. I did it like just to kind of as just a little stunt. Like I was just going to write about it and, you know, I was going to do it and I was going to go home and write about it and be like, that was awful. You know, like this was stupid. Improv's dumb. The end. but I had so much fun. I took just one intro class. It was supposed to be just one night and I had so much fun. I ended up signing up for a month long class and it's a cool way to interact with the world and people around you. I'm a person who really loves rules and likes to feel in control and likes to feel like I know what's coming next. I like when things are predictable. And this was the exact opposite of that, you know, on purpose. And it was actually really fun. It kind of helped me like get over myself and loosen up and just be a little more comfortable with not knowing what's coming next, which I think is a really good thing.
I have to be honest, I had the exact same experience.
Really?
I was so scared. Yeah. And then I was like, that was really fun.
I know.
It took me outside of myself. And I think a big part of it, to be honest, is that the improv community, the people who teach improv classes are so supportive.
Oh my God. Yes. Well, I think a lot of people come to it who are a little shy or are like maybe do have a little social anxiety. This is just anecdotal, but just the people I've talked to who are, you know, improv teachers and who are really into it, they'll tell me privately, like, yeah, I was so afraid of public speaking. You know, one guy just told me the other day, like he would just regularly vomit before having to go talk on stage when he had some, talk in a meeting. Yeah. So it's probably some of that kindness is because they see the fear in the new people's eyes and they're like, oh, I remember that, you know, but it's a cool community. It is a cool thing. I expected to hate it and I just loved it. So,
oh, that's good to hear. Yeah, it was a lot of fun and I went with a friend, which I was like, oh my God, why did I do that?
Yeah.
'Cause I'm almost more embarrassed in front of somebody I know.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of another part of my awkwardness theory, you know, like, you know how it's like weird when you like, you mix groups of friends, you know, like if like your school college friends hang out with like your home friends or like your family hangs out with your work friends or something. Mm-hmm. I think part of the situations we call awkward is when the version of yourself you're trying to present is somehow like incompatible with reality and that becomes clear in some way. And so if you are trying to be this professional person with your work friends and then your college friends show up and like know you as this like drunk fool, then you're kind of playing two roles at once. And I think that tension is what we call awkward. And I think that's partly why also it felt weird to have your friend in the class because you kind of wanted to be this like freewheeling, you know, game person trying improv. But then like your friend knows you in other contexts. And like, yeah, it's that tension of trying to be two people at once a little bit.
So. Oh, absolutely. And I think also, you know, that's really why for a lot of people, college is such an important life sort of experience and life change, because in a way they get to sort of reset mm-hmm. the clock and start over.
Oh, yeah. Or starting a new job or moving to a new city. Yeah. It can be so nice to...
All right. Well, Melissa, I've been learning so much. This has been so much fun. And I've kept you for a little longer than I promised I would. So I would love to wrap this up by asking you the same two questions that I ask everybody at the end of the show. Are you game? They're kind of big picture.
Ooh, sounds fun.
Ooh, yeah. All right. So I want you to think of whatever's relevant to you kind of in your mind right now, whether it's, and we're talking about the future. So whether it's like the future of your life, your career, your whatever, or it's like bigger picture, the future of humanity, the future of the earth, whatever. Number one, what is the thing that you really obsess about? It sort of keeps you up at night. You're constantly thinking about and maybe kind of bummed out, like you're not feeling great about. But on the flip side of that, so that we can end on a less awkward note, what is it that you are really, you know, excited about and looking forward to and have kind of a lot of optimism for?
Ooh, these are really good questions. Okay, the first one is kind of a bummer, which I guess is the point, but
yep.
But I think we should all be more afraid of like the flu and like infectious diseases. I think that's what they say is gonna kill us all. People who know about this stuff. Meanwhile, we freak out about things like, I don't know, like Ebola obviously is also awful, but the people who know what they're talking about say that it's just gonna be a regular old flu that wipes us all out, and kind of. Not exactly the same thing, but I find antibiotic resistance completely terrifying too. And I don't know why we're not
absolutely.
All talking about this all the time. Like what? it's so scary. Like every time, my dad like cut his finger the other day, and I just like really was watching it. Like, is it healing? You know, like oh my god, I just don't know why we're not always freaked out about that. I'm so with you.
Yeah. I've had MRSA. It was horrifying.
Oh my
I'm
God.
Obsessed with Maren McKenna and her work.
Yes.
And everything that she writes about.
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah. If I just want to go into like a fear spiral, like I'll watch one of her TED Talks or something. Like it's just like, but it's stuff that like we all should be, it kind of is like, I mean, it's like climate change too, obviously is just like the one of the huge problems that eventually is going to come for us all. Like why are we not talking about this every day? What's going on? Yeah. So that's terrifying.
It's true. It's true. I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
But what is exciting for you? What are you looking forward to?
So, I mean, just kind of another like big picture thing. I think maybe we're all feeling this way, but I am so excited about the teens. The teens are going to save us. Or, well, that's not fair to put it on them, but the teens, I mean, just these Parkland kids are just so amazing. I'm not even that old. I'm 30, going to be 33, but I feel so cynical. I just have felt like certain things can't change. And then here are these kids that like just had the worst day of their life, and their response is to just get fired up about it and to say like, no, this, you know, the hashtag never again, this can change. This will change. We will make sure it changes. And I don't want to fall into the trope of like, oh, they'll save us all, because I want to help them, but I think they're going to be leading it. And I think that's just get super corny. I'm so inspired by the teens.
Oh, I'm so with you. And I'm so glad you brought that up. I don't think anybody's brought that up yet on the show. And it really is like, just it also sort of saves me from myself on a regular basis when I go to Twitter and I turn on the news and I'm super depressed. And then I'm like, yes, they're on it.
I think they have some real sense just in that. I think this was like an analysis of kind of their behavior or something like that, or their responses. And the way they just ignore the president. I don't even want to say his name because it makes me mad, but just they just ignore him. You know, that's kind of the just leave him out. Ignore him. He's not helping. He's not going to help us. Like, let's just not even focus on that. Let's focus on what matters, and let's make some changes. That is what really gives me some real optimism. I was at a soccer game the other day, like a professional soccer game, and it was really, really crowded, and somebody, you know, bumped into me, and it was like I turned around to be all annoyed, and it was like a gaggle of teen girls, and I was like, aw, you're fine. Like, just bump into me, that's fine.
Oh my gosh, you're so funny. I'm so glad that we had this chat.
Yeah, me too. This has been fun.
It has been fun and not at all awkward. Guys, the book is Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness by Melissa Dahl. You can buy it anywhere books are sold right now, and I'll have a link out to it on the show notes. Melissa, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much. This was so fun.
Absolutely. And everyone else listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.